You are listening to Session 3 of the Redemptive Unity Seminar Series from the spring of 2020. If you haven't yet listened to Sessions 1 and 2, we recommend you start there. Again, our guest speaker is Dr. Sean Lucas, Senior Pastor at Independent Pres in Memphis, Tennessee. Listen and learn well.
Well, good morning. Here's what I want to do. I want to back up just briefly, remind us where we've been. And then I'm going to go ahead and pick up where I left off in Genesis, because I think it's really important before we kind of get into the rest of the Old Testament, into the New Testament story, to see that this isn't just selected text, that the Bible's story of God's mission to our world is that God is calling out of the nations, out of the languages, out of the clans, out of the peoples. He's calling a people for himself, yes, but it's a cross-cultural, it's a multiracial, multi-ethnic, multicultural people centered on the cross of Jesus Christ, okay? So I want us to be able to see that, and I want us to see that this pattern of inclusion is not just a New Testament thing, but is in fact a whole Bible thing. There's many great things about being Presbyterian. One of the great things about being Presbyterian is we're a whole Bible people. We really do believe this is a single story. God doesn't change his mind midway through. God is actually at work with a single redemptive storyline, and I want you to see that. So last night we were talking about how reconciliation is the goal of the gospel, that in and through the cross of Jesus Christ, God reconciles all things to himself. He reconciles us to him as an example of what that looks like when he reconciles all things to himself, but he also reconciles us to one another. And as we are reconciled to one another, that too is a picture of what God is going to do, because God is reconciling all things to himself. He is tying up all the loose strands, all the loose strings. He's summing them all up, uniting all things in Christ. And so we looked at the first 12 chapters of Genesis last night and saw how out of the fountainhead of humanity, Adam and Eve, all races contained in there, hence all in the image of God. But also the fountainhead of humanity was all corrupted in the fall. So there's no one race or ethnicity that's more sinful than another or less sinful than another. We all partake in Adam and Eve's sin. And yet God doesn't leave us to ourselves. Rather, his intention is to draw out of the nations a people for himself. That was the promise that he made to Abraham, that all the clans, all the families of the earth would be blessed through a son of Abraham. And that's where we finished. We saw how the genealogy of Jesus, it begins the genealogy of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. Why son of Abraham? Well, among the many reasons why is it's a signal that this promise made back in Genesis 12, that the nations would come to be blessed through Abraham. Well, here he is. His name's Jesus. And all those who put their trust in Jesus, whether white, black, brown, when we put our trust in Jesus, we too are sons and daughters of Abraham, which means what? We're family. We're family. Now, sometimes in families, you have to listen hard to one another. Sometimes in families, you don't always have the same perspectives on things. But we are members of the household of God, Paul says in Ephesians 2. So what we need now to trace, as I have on this slide, is how does this promise made to Abraham, how does it play out? And there's two questions out of that I want you to keep in mind as we work our way through these Old Testament texts. And the first is, are there signs, even in the Old Testament, that God is blessing the peoples, the nations, the languages, the lands, this diversity, this ethnic diversity that God names in the Table of Nations in Genesis 10, are there signs that God, even in the Old Testament, is blessing the peoples through Abraham and his descendants? And along that line, second question, is there inclusion for others outside of Abraham's family in the people of God? So all that ethnic diversity of the Old Testament world that we talked about, the Semites and the Cushites, the Egyptians, the Indo-Europeans, I mean, do we see signs that that ethnic diversity that we can name historically, sociologically, that God names in the Old Testament, do we see that included in the people of God, even in the Old Testament? Because we would expect if God's mission to his world is to form a multiracial, multiethnic people, we're whole Bible people, we would expect to see it in the whole Bible, right? So those are the two questions we need to trace out. And I am going to kind of be selective here at the first part before we get into the wisdom literature and the prophets. But just some pictures. One question, who marries into Abraham's family? If Abraham's family, from Abraham to Isaac down to Jacob, who is Israel, and his 12 sons, who marries into Abraham's family? Who's included? Well, think about it. Judah, according to Genesis 38, one of those chapters that in your family Bible reading you might skip over because it's a bit of a tawdry scene, but Genesis 38, Judah actually marries a Canaanite. Genesis 38, it happened at that time that Judah went down to his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. There Judah saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son. She called his name Onan. Yet again she bore a son. She called his name Shelah. So, Canaanites, right? We've already seen through Genesis 9, we call it the curse of Ham. It's not the curse of Ham. It's really the curse on Canaan. And then we saw in Genesis 10, oh wait, they're part of the rogues gallery, the Canaanites. We should be signaling, oh wait a second, Judah, who we know from the rest of the Bible is a really important character, and his tribe that's going to come from him is a really important tribe because, oh, Jesus comes from this tribe. Judah is marrying a Canaanite. And in fact, he's going to have children with his daughter-in-law, Tamar. That's not a pretty scene. She also is a Canaanite. So there's already, early in the story, inclusion. And in fact, Tamar's child is going to be right in the line of Jesus. Joseph in Genesis 41, as I mentioned briefly last night, after he becomes prime minister of Egypt, who does he marry? Well, Genesis 41, verse 45, and Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphath-Paniah, and he gave him in marriage Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over the land of Egypt, and he's going to have two kids by this Egyptian woman, Manasseh and Ephraim. Who's the most important of the northern 10 tribes of Israel? Ephraim. Who was his mama? An Egyptian. Already there are those who are being included, these descendants of the sons of Ham. Even though they are cursed, even though there's this expectation as Israel sitting on the plains of Moab getting ready to go into the promised land, oh wait, the peoples of Canaan, the descendants of Ham, they're under a curse. Yet those who are under a curse are redeemed by being brought into the story. And so much so that a descendant of Tamar the Canaanite would be in fact Jesus the Christ. Moses' wives, think about his family. I mean, we know from Exodus chapter 2 that Moses marries Zipporah, and Zipporah is a Midianite. The Midianites were a Semitic cousin of the Israelites descended through Midian, a son born to Abraham through his maid wife, Keturah, which is itself kind of a funky deal. As an aside to that, Zipporah is the daughter of whom? Well, she's the daughter of a priest who worships Baal. Like, this is not the kind of girl you want your son coming home with, right? I mean, this has got some weird stuff to it, and yet she is included, brought into this key pastor's family by marriage, Moses. Think of it. Moses marries the daughter of a priest of Baal. Joseph marries the daughter of a priest of an Egyptian god. And yet, they are included. And over time, their families come to worship Yahweh, the true God, whom we know as Father, Son, Spirit. At some point, Moses has brought his people, his wife and family with him. He sends them back because of the concern of what's going to happen during the Exodus, and sends them, his family, back to the Midianites. Later in the story, what happens with the Midianites? You remember? Well, the Midianites are going to join the Moabites in trying to prevent Israel from coming to the promised land. So that means Moses' in-laws, you always got to pay attention to your in-laws, right? Moses' in-laws are going to try to prevent him and God's people from coming to the promised land. Not a good situation. And yet, some of the Midianites are included because they become part of Moses' family. Moses has another wife. In Numbers chapter 12, right at the, it's just kind of there. Moses and Aaron, Numbers 12, verse 1, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married. For he had married a Cushite woman. Remember what I said? When the Bible doesn't have bold and italics, so when it wants to use bold and italics, it repeats. Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he married, for he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, "Well, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?" That's a red herring. They're not upset because they think Moses is monopolizing the speaker platform. They're upset. Why? Because of the Cushite woman he's married. And the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was very meek, more than all the people on the face of the earth. And suddenly the Lord said to Moses and Aaron and to Miriam, "Come out, you three, to the tents of meeting." And the three of them came out. And the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the entrance of the tent and called Aaron and Miriam. And they both came forward. And he said, "Hear my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make himself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He's faithful in all my house. With him I speak mouth to mouth clearly and not in riddles. And he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?" And the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, and he departed. And behold, when the cloud removed from over the tent, behold, Miriam was leprous like snow. And Aaron turned to Miriam, and behold, she was leprous. So Moses marries a Cushite. It's repeated twice. They use this as an excuse to attack Moses. He's dominating as the prophet of God's people. God corrects that, but also gets at the underlying issue. How do we know? Because of the judgment. Remember, the Cushites, these were African peoples. The Cushites were a kingdom south of Egypt at the headwaters of the Nile. Elsewhere in the Bible, especially in the New Testament, the Cushites will be referred to as Ethiopian, which was the Greek way of talking about dark faces or burnt faces, literally. And so this Cushite is a black African. Good reasons to see this woman as a different wife from Zipporah. And I give you some reasons there. I'm not going to touch them. The main thing to notice here is that Moses marries this woman. Miriam and Aaron speak against her. God deals and corrects their theology, but also deals with the underlying issue. How do we know? Because Miriam becomes white. They criticize him for marrying a Cushite, a black woman. Miriam becomes leprous, as white as snow. How does that strike you? Being white at judgment? What? No. But there is a judgment here. And finally, God relents after Moses intercedes. Aaron says to Moses, "Oh my Lord, do not punish us because we've done foolishly and have sinned. Let her not be as one dead whose flesh is half eaten away when she comes out of his mother's womb." Moses cried to the Lord, "Oh Lord, oh God, please heal her, please." But the Lord said, "If her father had spit in her face, shouldn't she not be shamed 7 days? Let her be shut outside the camp 7 days, and after that she may be brought in again." So Miriam was shut outside the camp 7 days, and the people did not set out on the march till Miriam was brought in again. So one of the reasons why that's important is this goes back to why I mentioned all the ethnic diversity in the Bible. We don't tend, because we think everyone in the Bible looks like us, we don't tend to see the colors and the ethnic diversity And so we may not pick up on the fact that Moses married a Cushite. And what does that mean? Perhaps you were raised in situations where you were taught that interracial marriage was wrong. And yet, here are examples, whether it's Judah, whether it's Joseph, whether it's Moses, where that's clearly not the case. What's determinative is, in fact, whether someone is willing to be part of the people of God, willing to follow after Yahweh, the true God whom we know as Father, Son, Spirit. There's inclusion among for the nations, for the ethnic diversity of the world, among God's people, and you see it in who these folks are marrying. But you also see it in who's redeemed in the Passover or in the Exodus. Or to put it differently, who were those who came out of Egypt? Were they only the direct descendants of Abraham? Or were there other races and ethnicities who came out and were included among God's people? Well, even the way I've set that up, you can guess the answer. In Exodus chapter 12, and starting in verse 37, you have a description of the folks who are coming in the Exodus. And the people of Israel, the Bible says, journey from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot besides women and children. A mixed multitude also went up with them, and very much livestock, both flocks and herds. So you have the people of Israel, ostensibly descendants of Abraham, but although we've already seen there's all sorts of folks who are marrying in, but alongside the people of Israel, a mixed multitude. Well, what's that? Well, that's the nations. Remember, Egypt's the crossroads of the ancient world. Peoples from Asiatic and Semitic peoples from Mesopotamia and Palestine come through Egypt. The Cushites come up through Egypt. Northern Africa comes through Egypt. Egypt's this melting pot where there's all sorts of diversity, all sorts of intermarriage, and this mixed multitude of the nations, they too go up with God's people heading off to the promised land. And what's the very next thing that happens in Exodus chapter 12? Have you ever wondered this? They go out on the Exodus, and immediately God talks about the Passover. And in the midst of talking about the Passover, he gives instructions of how foreigners are to eat it, right? He says, this is the statute, no foreigners of the Passover, no foreigners shall eat of it, but every slave that's bought for money may eat of it after you've circumcised it. No foreigner or hired worker may eat of it, it shall be eaten in one house. So, and then verse 48, if a stranger shall sojourn with you and would keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised. Then he may come near and keep it. He shall be as a native of the land, but no uncircumcised person shall eat of it. Well, what's circumcision? Circumcision is the Old Testament sign of initiation in the people of God. What's the New Testament sign of initiation in the people of God? Oh, baptism, right? And so in order to keep the Passover, you have to be what? You have to be identified with the people of God, which means you have to be identified with whom? Israel's God. So the issue is not ethnicity. The issue is loyalty to the God who's come. That's the issue for the people of God. It's not just direct descendants of Abraham, some kind of pure bloodline. From the very beginning of the scriptures, all through the Exodus, what's the pattern? A multiracial, multi-ethnic people centered on faith in this God who's come to deliver them. Right? That's what you have going on in Exodus. And God makes provision for the nations to be part of his people from the very get-go. So what about those prohibitions about marrying foreigners? This again gets to this very issue. In Deuteronomy 7, you have these instructions which are fascinating. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of it and clears away the many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and mightier than you, and when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must devote them to complete destruction. You shall make no covenant with them, show no mercy to them. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will destroy you quickly. So what's the concern? What's the concern about intermarrying with the seven nations that are presently in Palestine? Well, the concern is not racial or ethnic. The concern is religious. Intermarriage with the Canaanites, God fears, will turn your children away from following him. That's the issue. That's the concern. So one of the things when we think about that, the prohibition against intermarriage with the Canaanites, because it's religious and not ethnic, it's not about some kind of strange kind of ethnic reality of this text, these Old Testament prohibitions against intermarriage with the nations of Palestine were used by defenders of segregation in the 60s to argue that God prohibited marriage between whites and blacks, right? But that's not the concern here. The concern is not ethnic. Remember, the Canaanites look like and are similar ethnicity to the Israelites. The concern is not ethnic. The concern is religious. And in fact, in Deuteronomy 21, God makes another provision. When Israel goes to war with enemies outside of Canaan, they might marry the captured women. If the captured women consent to be part of the family, consent to follow after the Lord, because the concern's not ethnic, it's religious. That's the concern. So it's important when we think about who's included, how are we included, that even in the Old Testament, you have examples of God including the nations based on their loyalty to Israel's God, because that's God's mission. And when you come to the wisdom literature, especially the Psalms, you find this is the case. Of course, the Psalms are the hymn book of God's people. These are the songs that God's people would have sung regularly in their worship services, in their personal devotions. These were the things that they knew not only in their heads, but in their hearts. And what you find as you work your way through the Psalms is that God's mission is all through this. There's going to come a promised Davidic king who's going to rule over the nations. His rule, his people, would include people from every land, language, clan, and nation. The language of Genesis 10, the diversity of the nations is represented by the Table of Nations, is all throughout the Psalms promised to the Davidic king, the coming Messiah. So we're going to take a quick tour. Psalm 2, verse 8, ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and the ends of the earth your possession. Of course, Psalm 2, one of the great messianic psalms, and God says to his Messiah, ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage. Psalm 18, and verse 43, you have delivered me from the attacks of the people. You have made me the head of nations. People I did not know now serve me. Foreigners cower before me. As soon as they hear of me, they obey me. These are the words of the Messiah. And he says, you have made me the head of nations. The Messiah is going to be the king over a people that's drawn from the nations. Psalm 22, which is, we know probably best as a messianic psalm in relationship to the crucifixion of Jesus. But at the end of the psalm, in Psalm 22, verse 27, all the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations shall worship before you. Wait. What was the promise to Abraham? All the families of the earth shall be blessed through you. And here you have the Messiah, a messianic psalm in which he says, all the families of the nations shall worship before you. Why? For kingship belongs to the Lord. He rules over the nations. The Lord's Messiah is going to be the one who not only is forsaken so that he might redeem a people, but as he redeems this people, he's going to redeem the nations. The families of the nations shall come and worship before you. Another messianic psalm, Psalm 45. Toward the end of that psalm, the psalmist says, I will cause your name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore, nations will praise you forever and ever. Wait a second. The nations will praise you forever and ever? So the Moabites, the Canaanites, the Egyptians, the Cushites, the Syrians, Babylonians, all of this diversity, yet there's going to be peoples drawn from those nations, and all the nations will praise you forever and ever. How's that going to happen? It's going to happen through this one of whom Psalm 45 says, "You are the most handsome of the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. In your majesty, ride out victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of your kingdom is a scepter of uprightness. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you." Who's this talking about? Well, the writer of the Hebrews tells you who that's talking about. It's talking about Jesus. Hebrews chapter 1 quotes Psalm 45. So if this is about Jesus, then what's going to happen when Jesus rules over his world? The nations will praise you forever and ever. Psalm 47, of course, a great missionary psalm. God reigns over the nations. God is seated on his holy throne. The nobles of the nations assemble as the people of the God of Abraham. The kings of the earth belong to God. He is greatly exalted. Psalm 67, Old Testament scholar David Howard calls Psalm 67 a missionary psalm. He says, "No other psalm captures more clearly and simply the grand vision that God is the God of all peoples and nations." And it starts with the Aaronic blessing. "May God be gracious to us and bless us and make his face to shine upon us, that your way may be known upon the earth and your saving power among all nations. Let the peoples praise you, O God. Let all the peoples praise you. Let the nations be glad and sing for joy." Now, we know these psalms. We've heard these things, right? They've fueled international missions from North America for years. What you've got to see is it's not simply about going over there. It's about going over there. But God's mission is everyone to everybody everywhere, which means then we need to lift our eyes and see, okay, what does it look like for the peoples to praise God here in Johns Creek or here in Memphis, Tennessee? The peoples that are being brought by the very hand of God here. If God's mission is a multiracial, multiethnic, multicultural people centered on the cross of Jesus Christ, then it's not just capital C church, it's also all the little C churches in all the respective places, so that we begin to reflect the place we are in. For generations, we have sent missionaries all around the world from North America, even while we've been content to live segregated lives here. Brothers and sisters, that must not be so. If this is in fact the word of God, and God's mission is in fact what I'm telling you it is, what the psalmist is, what the very songs that we're singing say, that the nations will be glad because they are under the rule of Jesus the King. Psalm 68 is a psalm of God ruling over his world, scattering his enemies. But in the midst of that, fascinatingly, because of your temple in Jerusalem, verse 28, "Kings shall bear gifts to you. Rebuke the beasts that dwell among the reeds, the herds of the bulls with the calves of the people. Trample under feet those who lust after tribute. Scatter the peoples who delight in war. Nobles shall come from Egypt. Cush shall hasten to stretch out her hands to God." So the Egyptians, brown-skinned people, the Cushites, black-skinned people, and yet part of the people of God, included within God's people, yes? Psalm 72, another messianic psalm where the messianic king is going to have dominion. Verse 8, "May he have dominion from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. May desert tribes bow down before him and his enemies lick the dust. May the kings of Tarshish," which equates close to Spain, "and of the coastlands render him tribute. May the kings of Sheba and Seba bring gifts." And you have that scene in 1 Kings where the queen of Sheba comes and brings gifts. Well, may the all kings bow down before him, all nations serve him. Who's the him? The coming messianic king. Who's that? Jesus. Which means God's mission, again, is to call out the nations to be part of his people. under the rule of Jesus the King. A little bit further, Psalm 86, one of my favorite psalms in the entire Psalter. Psalm 86, there's none like you among the gods, O Lord, nor are there any works like yours. All the nations you have made shall come and worship before you and shall glorify your name, for you are great and do wondrous things. You alone are God. So God is great, no works like yours. All the nations shall come and worship before you. And yes, that's happening today. There's not a time zone, all 24 time zones on a Lord's Day. The praise of God moves from time zone to time zone to time zone. It's a glorious truth. But God's bringing the nations here to hear. And so it's not enough to rejoice that God's reaching people there. This multiracial, multiethnic, multicultural people needs to be here because the nations are here also. Everyone's going to everybody everywhere. Psalm 87, glorious things of the year spoken, that great hymn of the faith draws from this psalm. On the holy mount stands the city he founded. The Lord loves the gates of Zion more than all the dwelling places of Jacob. Glorious things of you are spoken, O city of God. Among those who know me, I mentioned Rahab, Canaanite, and Babylon. Behold, Philistia, those Indo-European peoples, and Tyre with Cush, Africans. This one was born there, they say. And of Zion it shall be said, this one, that one were born in her. For the Most High himself will establish her. The Lord records as he registers the peoples, this one was born there. What's the psalmist saying? That in Zion the nations are born, or born again, right? It's a glorious psalm that the glory of Zion is that the nations are there, born in that place under the rule of its king, saying that all my springs, all of my sustenance is in you, is in this place where the Lord rules. Psalm 96, another psalm of praise that draws in the nations. Ascribe to the Lord, all you families of the nations, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. The nations, the families are included. Psalm 98, verse 2, the Lord has made his salvation known and revealed his righteousness to the peoples. Psalm 102, the nations will fear the name of the Lord, and all the kings of the earth will serve you. And Psalm 117, the shortest psalm in the Bible. And yet, praise the Lord, all the nations, extol him, all peoples, for great is his steadfast love towards us, and the faithfulness of the Lord endures forever. So, I stopped at Psalm 117. You can keep going, right? But I kind of did this fire hose approach just so you can see that those trip words of Genesis 10 of family and language and nations and peoples, the way that Israel talks about the ethnic diversity of the world, it included among God's people, which means then that God's mission to his world is to forge a people that's multiracial, multiethnic, multicultural. And that's not just capital C church, that's little C church. But that's true not just as you have these clues of inclusion in the Pentateuch, not just the broad sweep of the wisdom literature represented by the Psalms, but the prophets too. Isaiah, for example. While the focus of the prophets is on Israel's faithlessness and on calling God's people back to their God, yet throughout the prophets, and especially in Isaiah, you have this picture of what God's intention is, of what God's mission is, that Israel would be a witness to the nations, and that there would be one multiracial, multiethnic people worshiping and serving God. That's the picture that you get from Isaiah. Now, one of the things you have to keep in mind when you read Isaiah, and especially the prophets after Isaiah, chronologically speaking, is that Egypt is actually ruled by the Cushites. The 25th dynasty in Egypt, which lasts from about 760 to about 656 BC, it's also called the Nubian or the Cushite dynasty. It's during that period that the pyramids were built. Think about that. The pyramids were actually built by Cushites, by Sudanese, we would say today, as they ruled over Egypt. So when you think then about Egypt, you're thinking about a nation that's currently ruled by black Africans. He's also going to refer, Isaiah is also going to refer to Cush also, but he's going to refer to Egypt more frequently. And so you're thinking about this ethnically diverse peoples, the Egyptians, that are being ruled over during this period by Cushites. So if you think in terms of race, in terms of color, you're going to have to recalibrate the way you're reading the Bible. There's all kinds of color going on in Isaiah and the later prophets. Danny Hayes writes, the book of Isaiah advances the concept of equal salvation for all peoples and nations more than any other prophetic book. The prophet paints an eschatological picture of people from all nations blending together with the remnant of Israel as the true people of Yahweh. So just so you can see that briefly, won't hit all the passages that I have here on my slides, but Isaiah 2, this picture of this mountain, it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and it shall be lifted up above the hills, and all the nations shall flow to it. And many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and then may we walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the Lord, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations, he shall decide disputes for many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hook. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Why is that the case? Well, it's because the nations have come to Zion. This multiracial, multi-ethnic people has come to the place of God, where God dwells, to be under his rule. Well, what's that a picture of? Well, the church, right? What does the writer of Hebrews says? You have come to the mountain of the Lord, to Zion, to Jesus, Hebrews chapter 12. So that the church, where Jesus rules, is the place where the nations come. Isaiah chapter 11, a messianic prophecy concerning the branch, and what does the branch do? Well, in that day, the root of Jesse, who shall stand as a signal for the peoples, of him shall the nations inquire, and his resting place shall be glorious. In that day, the Lord shall extend his hand yet a second time and recover the remnant that remains of his people. And these aren't Jews. These are the peoples, his people, that belong to him, from Assyria, from Egypt, from Pathros, from Cush, from Elam, from Shinar, from Hamath, from the coastlands of the sea, from north, east, west, south. His people, the Messiah's people, the branch's people, they're the ones who are going to come and submit to the one who is the root of Jesse. Well, that's what's happened. The nations have come to Jesus. Yes. Isaiah 19 and 20, prophecies concerning Egypt and Cush. You have this amazing prophecy at the end of chapter 19. In that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. So think of this. About 720 BC, Israel's in between these two powers, Assyria and Egypt, ethnic others, religious others. But God says, in that day, there shall be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, which means it's going to run through what? The Holy Land. That doesn't sound reassuring. And yet, Assyria will come into Egypt and Egypt into Assyria, and the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. And in that day, Israel will be a third with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom God, the Lord of hosts, is blessed, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. So Egypt and Israel and Assyria, erstwhile enemies, will become one people, and there will be blessing in the midst of the earth, and they will submit to Yahweh of hosts, and Yahweh will be blessing, and there will be blessing given. Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, Israel, my inheritance. Why? People of God. One people of God. Isaiah 27, this prophecy, in that day a great trumpet will sound. Those who were perishing in Assyria and those who were exiled in Egypt shall come and worship the Lord on the holy mountain in Jerusalem, that holy mountain of Isaiah 2, Zion. So it's not becoming Jews, they become part of the people of God. They're included. This is what God's mission's all about. Isaiah 42, which is a messianic prophecy. Isaiah 42 is one of the servant songs. Behold my servant whom I am uphold, my chosen in whom my soul delights. Who's that said about? This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased when Jesus is baptized. So, behold my servant whom I uphold, my chosen in whom my soul delights. I put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. Verse 4, he will not grow faint or be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands wait for his law. Thus says God, the Lord, who created the heavens and the earth and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and what comes from it, who gives breath to the people and the spirit who walks on it. I am the Lord. I've called you in righteousness. I will take you by the hand and keep you. I will give you as a covenant for the people, a light for the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeons, from the prison, those who sit in darkness. I am the Lord. That is my name. So I will make you a light for the nations. Who? Well, this servant. Who's that? Jesus. And in case we miss it, it's mentioned once again in another of the servant songs, Isaiah 49. This is great. This is so cool. And now says the Lord, he who formed me from the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob back to him, that Israel might be gathered to him. For I'm honored in the eyes of the Lord, and my God has become my strength. He says, it is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel. I will make you as a light for the nations, that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. If we are mistaken about the mission of the Messiah, that he is going to simply be for a particular ethnic people, God makes it plain in the Old Testament, No, I made you a light for the nations, because my mission has always been, from the beginning to the end, that the nations might be included among the people of God. Time fails me to mention the other prophets. But you find this in Amos. You find it in Micah, a vision that's very similar to Isaiah chapter 2. Zephaniah actually is the son of Cushi, the Cushites. So Zephaniah was likely a black Jew. And his own prophecies point in this direction. Let me summarize. No, I don't have a time. Let me summarize briefly. From Genesis 12 on, in this rapid overview, okay, so about 35 or 40 minutes worth, from Genesis 12 on, while God's focus is especially on Abraham's family, no doubt, Israel, he continually demonstrates his intention to bless the families of the earth through his sons, right? Through Israel. This intention to bless is revelatory, telling the truth about God, but especially salvific. The nations were to be saved. The nations were to be included among God's people through faith and identification with Israel's God. And so God's intention throughout the Old Testament was for his people to be a multiracial, multiethnic people, to include black Africans and Egyptians and Assyrians and other nations as well. And then when you get to the Psalms and especially the prophets like Isaiah, the promised Messiah, the Davidic king, he's going to bring this about. He is going to extend and expand his people to include Jew and Gentile people from every territory, from every tribe, clan, nation, language. We've seen family. We've seen all of those words used just in our English Bibles of what the Messiah is coming to do. So after our discussion, the question we're going to ask when we come to the New Testament is that what Jesus does? Well, you already know the answer, right? So if that's what Jesus actually begins to accomplish, is accomplishing, and will accomplish, is going to raise a question for us at the end. Well, what are we to do? What's our mission? Okay? So we have some discussion questions for you. About 10 minutes worth, Jimmy, you think? Is that good? Okay. So two big questions here that really focus on Psalms and Prophets. So as you start paying attention to the repetition of the nations and the peoples in the Psalms, you see it everywhere. So in what ways do these categories, which are drawn, remember, from Genesis 10, Help us recognize that God's mission is to call a diverse people drawn from a range of racial and ethnic peoples to himself. And how should that shape our understanding of the people of God? When we talk about the people of God in the Bible, what do they look like? Who's included? Okay? And then, likewise, the prophets emphasize the same with their usage of nations and peoples. But they explicitly connect the inflow of the nations with the coming of the Davidic king, the coming of the Messiah. So discuss the ways in which the Psalms and the prophets prepare us for Jesus' own mission, that he was not simply calling a single people to himself, but he had come for the diverse peoples of the world.
Once again, thank you for taking the time to listen to this session of the Redemptive Unity Seminar Series from the spring of 2020. This was session number 3 of 4. Make sure to download and listen to the other sessions from this weekend. For more information about Perimeter Church and Redemptive Unity, visit us on the web at www.perimeter.org/redemptiveunity. Thank you, and God bless.